This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin, and on the Breakfast Grill with me today is Richard Toll, representative for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Malaysia. It's World Refugee Day. What an appropriate guest to have today. Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on the program.
We want to begin really looking at that 2015 boat people crisis, sometimes called the Asian boat people crisis. It was, you know, it was a spectacle for international media. Your assessment, your professional assessment of the international community's response to that crisis?
It showed a spotlight on something that we'd known about for a long time. We'd seen large numbers of people moving through the region, including coming into Malaysia for years before that, using these horrific smuggling and trafficking routes. So we were not surprised when we saw the discovery of mass graves in southern Thailand and northern Malaysia in May and earlier last year, which gave rise, as you know, to the boat people crisis of the Andaman Sea last year. We could see it coming, of course, the humanitarian consequences of it and the consequences for states at that time were very serious.
I mean, in what sense are intergovernmental organizations like yours passive observers? You see it coming. You know a country has, internal displaced camps for internally displaced. There's, you know, persecution. You can't actually do anything about the national situation in terms of the politics there. And so organizations like UNHCR are there merely as kind of a band-aid. Something goes wrong and we correct it. We correct or ameliorate the worst of the symptoms of a problem. You can never get to the problem itself. Is that a frustration for somebody like you who's worked with the UN system for so long?
It's the working reality that we live in. UNHCR is a humanitarian band-aid and we're not a substitute for political action. I think you've hit the nail on the head that the causes of displacement are usually rooted in a lack of fairness, inequalities and development, and sometimes that leads to violence and human insecurity and then displacement. So refugees around the world today are a barometer of how successful we are as societies and communities in sorting out problems and tensions in society. The bigger the number of refugees, the poorer we are at dealing with political and social issues at home. And clearly, if we are more effective in the international community generally at dealing with the root causes, then we don't have the need for refugees.
What was it in terms of the level or number of refugees last year? Do you have a ballpark figure?
Globally, the numbers were simply off the radar. We had millions of people displaced globally. The statistics are terribly sobering. Nearly 60 million people were displaced from their homes or affected by conflict insecurity last year. That's one in every 130 people on the planet today are in that category. That's double the population of Malaysia know what it's like to be forcibly evicted and separated from their homes and their tradition. So the numbers globally are simply astounding. And the consequences for us as one of the humanitarian agencies is how do we find the resources and the security environment to do our work effectively given the scale of numbers and given the physical insecurity where these things are happening.
Maybe we'll come back to the question of, you know, who's footing the bill on this human tragedy. But coming back to the 2015 boat people crisis, the fact is many of those individuals landed on our shores in Malaysia and on the peninsula. But Malaysia itself is not signatory to the 1951 Convention on the Rights of the Refugees or the, I believe, 67 Protocol. Is that an impediment for doing the best you can for those individuals that landed or were stranded in boats at high seas?
The crisis was not a crisis in numerical terms. It was a crisis in the lack of integrated cooperation between states in managing it. And for a period last year, a number of countries were not allowing refugees to disembark. They were pushing them back out to sea or off to other places in the hope that some other country would take responsibility. So the crisis last year in the Andaman Sea was a lack of coordination and responsibility sharing in the region. Not numerically. At the end of the day, there were 1,107 people who landed on Malaysian shores. of whom only about 370 were refugees. So it wasn't a refugee crisis that we faced in numerical terms last year, although I don't want to downplay how serious it was for those people affected. But the lesson we learned is that there has to be a much higher degree of cooperation and collaboration between states and the UN in the region to avert this kind of thing happening again.
I understand that you're a diplomat, or at least you work for intergovernmental organizations, so there are constraints on what you can say, and you're not from an NGO. NGOs and people representing NGOs tend to be much more vociferous in their criticism. But let's try this. To what extent has ASEAN failed to come to terms with some of the dynamics in the region, especially around issues of repression and refugees that result from that repression?
A personal reflection is that ASEAN is still finding its feet on some of these issues. The ASEAN declaration, the new economic unit of ASEAN, of course, in time will be a very effective constituency of states. But I think it's fair to say, as of today, ASEAN as a constellation of states is not dealing effectively with the consequences of forced migration coming into and through the region. It's a role that ASEAN can and should move towards in the future. But as of today, and I think this was highlighted in the Andaman Sea crisis of last year, there is no effective coordinated response to these kinds of crises, and there needs to be. Malaysia, after the crisis slowed down, took some leadership in trying to put in place the right mechanisms of cooperation to try and help avoid these things in the future. But it's a first step. There needs to be more done.
Is this because ASEAN as a whole, holds on to this policy of non-intervention in member states? They don't like to meddle, as it were, in the politics of member states. Though we've seen the consequence of not meddling. We have transnational boundary pollution. We have, because the refugee crisis, we have issues around labor from importing and exporting countries. What will it take for ASEAN to actually move faster on these questions? Because this is something that's not going to go away. People, thousands of people in Rakhine State in Myanmar continue to live in deplorable conditions. And there's a push factor, isn't there, for them?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. ASEAN is a constellation of states, and it has to be for individual states to decide how far they're going to use the structure and the mechanisms of ASEAN to be involved with issues that historically they've been uncomfortable in dealing with. The nature of state sovereignty and non-interference has resulted in a hands-off approach to many issues that relate to us. Having said that, I think there are changes. I think there is a recognition, as you say, is that no man is an island, as they say. No nation in this globalized world is an island nation. Everybody is affected. What might appear to be an issue that only affects the internal dynamics of a particular country often spills over. We've seen the crisis in Syria. This is a regional and a global crisis today. The Andaman Sea issue showed us last year that this is not just an issue of refugees from the Rakhine. It is an issue that affects the whole region, including the relationship between states in the region. So these are truly the refugee issue, as the smoke coming across this region, are things that affect all of us, all states, and the populations living within them. So that's really why we do need to have a more effective, integrated approach between states on tackling these kinds of issues.
40 years ago, Malaysia was, of course, involved in that other boat people crisis. I mean, I think maybe the original boat people crisis, because people fleeing Vietnam after the war. Do you think that in many ways, looking back at that case, that Malaysia did well, despite not being a signatory to the convention, despite its own reluctance to take on any of the Vietnamese? It was just we were in some sense a transit camp, were we, for people going to a third country. Was that good enough? Is that good enough? Should we applaud ourselves, pat ourselves on the back and say, hey, we did well by the Vietnamese?
Two answers to that. One is states don't have to sign the Refugee Convention to do the right thing for refugees. Here in Malaysia, refugees could have a much better existence if they were allowed to live here legally and allowed to work here legally. That doesn't involve signing the Refugee Convention. It can be done by a very modest change to the local laws and regulations. So I think sometimes the Refugee Convention is a little bit of a red herring. What is more important is the quality of protection and support that's offered by countries, whether they sign the convention or not. And the comprehensive plan of action for the Indochinese, as you've rightly identified, is a good example of how states in the region were able to cooperate to deal with a very difficult issue. It was a difficult issue from a humanitarian point of view, but also complex from a security and a political situation as well. By joining forces and having an agreed plan of action, all states were able to deal with and navigate their way through a complex problem. States that up until a certain moment of that history tried to go it alone proved to be unsuccessful. So it's the greatest advertisement why regional cooperation according to a set of agreed arrangements and ground rules is absolutely still the way to deal with refugee displacement in the 21st century, as indeed it was 30 or 40 years ago.
Recently, Malaysia also noted that it would welcome Syrian refugees, and this is part of the larger Syrian refugee crisis, and made gestures of, you know, getting the best people here, also providing them with three-bedroom apartments and such. But very recently, and your office has also confirmed this, that many of the victims from the Andaman Sea boat crisis, boat people crisis, remain in camps. And I imagine the situation in those camps cannot be very comfortable. Why is it that those victims remain in camps?
Well, first of all, we welcome the government's offer to bring in 3,000 Syrian refugees over 3 years. That's a very generous demonstration of solidarity to a horrendous problem that we're facing in the Middle East. And the numbers of people are coming here, and we very much welcome that. It is sad and disappointing that there are still over 320 of the original 370 people still in immigration detention from the Andaman Sea crisis last year. This includes women, children, victims of smuggling and trafficking. People have experienced terrible things in their own country, horrendous experiences on the boat journeys towards Malaysia and Indonesia, and who 1 year later are still in jail.
And why? Why are they there? Why are they still stuck? What's stopping them from getting care or going to a third country or being repatriated if they're safe enough to go home?
Well, that's something we're working with the government to try and find a solution. We don't think it's appropriate for them to stay in a detention setting, particularly given what they've been through. They've been through terrible things, and we need to see them. We need to offer them whatever psychosocial and other kinds of support they need to look after themselves and to get better. And we will work with government and some of our resettlement countries to try and find a solution for them. But it's very hard to do that while they're still in detention. And that's an ongoing discussion we've got with the government.
We left with the question of impact. And I think, many people around the world are doubtful about world government, about the effectiveness of intergovernmental organizations. They see them as slow, tending towards the path of least resistance, not being there on time. What do you make of these criticisms? I mean, do you think we are better off without something like a UNHCR, and that we could just deal with these problems on a regional level or on a national level? What would be the best solution? Is the UNHCR really an organization with impact?
UNHCR is created in 1950 with an original idea of only being around for 3 years. And the expectation was that after the Second World War and the displacement, that people would be able to go back to their homes and resume their lives. And the sad reality is that our mandate has been renewed periodically every 3 to 5 years since then, and is now a permanent mandate of the United Nations. We know that refugees is a situation that's not going to disappear. Our ideal situation is when governments and civil society take responsibility for refugees without us. We think that's the best outcome. This is the territory of a sovereign state, and the sovereign state should be looking after people in their territory in an appropriate way according to international standards. UNHCR will only step into those situations where there is a failure or a gap. And our role in Malaysia is only because there is a very large protection gap here. We don't particularly want to be here in 2016. We would rather be in the Middle East, in sub-Saharan Africa, looking after refugees who are desperately in need of help. But for the time being, there is no other agency or entity prepared to step forward to look after refugees in this region. So we have to do it. As to whether we're effective, I think the numbers speak for themselves. We are the thin blue line of protection for tens of millions of people around the world. We have found security and long-term safety for over 100,000 refugees out of Malaysia in the last 10 years who've gone on to the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and other countries. So there's 100,000 testimonies out there to say that UNHCR has done a good job.
And who's paid for all this?
The budget of UNHCR in crude dollar terms is provided by the international community. There are contributions from governments and from international donors globally that go into a broader pool of funds that we use to work. Here in Malaysia, the work provided by UNHCR and the services provided by UNHCR are at no cost at all to the Malaysian people. All the work that we do is done through alternative funding. There is no taxpayer money going towards protection of refugees in Malaysia.
Do you find that when you speak to ordinary Malaysians, they are concerned about any kind of generosity that if it was extended to refugees would result in a burden for the local population, that it would change the fabric of our society, that there would be all kinds of externalities, if you like, to use that kind of language, that come from being humane in our response?
The biggest obstacle to greater engagement in countries like Malaysia is the fact that refugees like migrants, unlawful migrants, are treated as illegals. And we think that one of the biggest obstacles for people really rolling up their sleeves and getting engaged is that they fear dealing with something that's illegal. These are ordinary people who have fallen on hard times. They're just like you and me. They're children and families that have suffered terribly and they need our help. And my impression over 2.5 years here in Malaysia is that Malaysians, by instinct, are very generous and very happy to put out the hand of friendship to look after refugees. That generosity would be magnified enormously if they were allowed to be here legally. We know that there are many refugees here anyway, and we think it makes a lot of sense from a number of different perspectives to actually allow people to be registered and to work here lawfully. We don't think that would lead to major pull factors into Malaysia. We don't think it would undermine the fabric of Malaysian society. The numbers are too small. We're only talking about 154,000 people against a population of over 20 million Malaysians. So it's not going to change or alter the fabric of Malaysian society at all. In fact, it would improve the relationship between Malaysians and refugees because people could be here and be counted and be seen instead of being driven into the underworld and the grey market and black market economy, which is currently the case.
Well, in Malaysia, we also have an issue with undocumented workers, people who come for economic reasons. And I think perhaps, when you listen to politicians from all sides of the divide, you sometimes are confused about actually what they're referring to. Are they referring to refugees? Are they talking about illegal migrants? Sometimes the argument is made that people are not persecuted back home. What they're looking for is economic opportunity when they come here. We've had situations where refugees have been here several generations. We had a big debate in Sabah about giving rights to children of refugees. So these are stateless children in the state of Sabah. So people who otherwise would align themselves with a democratic agenda also, vehemently against giving stateless children rights. And I mean, that conversation in Malaysia, I mean, you've been here several years now. I came in 2014. Do you find that the level of discourse about refugees and stateless people is sophisticated enough? I mean, where is it that we could find some clarity and push the arguments further, conversation deeper?
I think you've really gone to the heart of the problem, and that is in Malaysia there may be anything between 3 to 4 or maybe even higher million undocumented migrants. That means roughly 20% of the Malaysian population, de facto Malaysian population, don't have the legal right to be here. The numbers of refugees in that are very, very small. We have 154,000 refugees registered with us. Those are people who've been through a proper assessment to say that they're not migrants. These are people who have actually forced to leave their homes and their loved ones in their at the places that they call home because of conflict. And part of the problem that we face, not here only here in Malaysia, but globally, is there's conflation and confusion between migrants or illegal migrants and refugees. They are actually two very, very different characters of people. Migrants are people who generally choose to come, and usually for economic reasons and perhaps for social reasons. Refugees are forced to leave and desperately need a place to come to. And that's what we saw in the Andaman Sea last year, a very good example, actually, of the 1,107 people who came by boat to Malaysia. 370 were so-called Rohingya from Rakhine State in Myanmar, who are in need of international protection. They desperately need our help. The rest of them were Bangladeshi migrants who, with a bit of help, have gone home. So with a proper system, with a proper processing arrangement, you can actually distinguish between those who need help and those who don't. And you can help deal with what you have rightly identified as the key problem, this conflation and confusion that everybody is somehow here trying to exploit and take advantage of the hospitable Malaysian society, when the reality is that refugees are not here for those reasons. They're here because they need to help, and they're here because they have no other choice.
Richard, you're from Europe. I mean, broadly speaking, Europe includes Britain so far. I don't know how long.
Includes New Zealand as part of
Europe. Oh, so you're from New Zealand. Coming back to the European refugee crisis, I mean, looking as an old hand in the issue of refugees, when you look at the European crisis, what lessons do you think the world can learn from that event and those series of events, including the horrendous pictures that came out that moved people at the same time, caused a lot of consternation and pushback among European populations?
Well, I think the French have a wonderful expression which translates as the more things change, the more things remain the same. We've seen, sadly, the cycles of forced displacement en masse, large numbers, being repeated time and time and time again. The European Union project was designed to have a system that would be able to deal with these issues. And what's been clear in the course of the last 18 months is that with all of the mechanisms and the collaboration that exists in that sophisticated European Union system, that they were not able to cope. When the numbers of people had decided that they were moving in the direction of Europe, the system couldn't cope. And of course, then we see states defaulting to national interests, not in European Union interests, but in their own perceived domestic interests. And we've also seen within that opportunistic politicians and other forces taking advantage, trying to portray refugees as threats to security, threats to the survival and fabric of society, when they're not. So I think that the main lesson that we've learned is that no state is able to deal with these things on their own. The challenges are too big. And in times of peace and quiet, which is what we have now in this region, is a good opportunity to agree between governments and states as to how to deal with these issues more effectively when they come again. We don't think that the situation of forced displacement in the region is finished forever. We hope that's wrong, but we would be unsurprised if more boats started to come towards us again in the future.
You said earlier that it's not a question of, you know, getting countries to sign on the convention. That's not the so I'm not going to ask you that question. What are you doing to get Malaysia to sign on? But what about the question of that protection gap? You said that makes it important for the UNHCR to be in Malaysia. What could be done, and what's preventing that protection gap from being narrowed?
It's an interesting question on World Refugee Day today, because later this morning we're having a roundtable precisely on looking at the issue of what are the challenges and opportunities if refugees would be allowed to work here in Malaysia legally. At the moment, refugees, like others, are destined to this life of illegality, and they are consigned to difficult, dangerous, and dirty, the 3D jobs that others don't want.
To a Malaysian purgatory.
Highly exploitative, dangerous positions, which actually contribute to the Malaysian economy. We believe, and these will be some of the issues that are looked at the workshop this morning in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur, is to try and see the benefits that will actually arise if refugees are allowed to work. If I may add a little on that, if refugees can work, it means that law and order will be more effectively dealt with, because you will know who's in your territory. You can capture biometric details of who these people are. They're here anyway. So a system that flushes them out through a registration process that the government is involved in makes a lot of sense if you're concerned about security. The economy would make more, would have a huge benefit for the economy if refugees were allowed to work lawfully. We know there are many, many businesses that would love to employ refugees legally, but at the moment they're not allowed to without breaking the law. So from an economic point of view, it makes a great deal of sense. And from a human point of view, if refugees are allowed to work lawfully, they're less dependent on the host state. They have better health care, better education outcomes, less likely to get caught up in crime, and less likely to be a burden on the generosity of Malaysian society. So we think that that's an unanswerable win-win all round. And what it does require is some very modest changes to policy and a tweaking a little bit of the regulatory framework. It doesn't require Malaysia to sign the convention, but it does require a very modest, sensible change of policy.
Thank you very much, Richard. I was speaking to Richard Toll, representative for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Malaysia. I'm Sharad Kutan, and this has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.